The Digital Banking Podcast is powered by Typhoon. Typhoon is a dramatically better digital banking provider. Our appeal is unique. We collaborate closely with our customers and the banking ecosystem in an open approach coupled with a powerful user experience that helps get things done. On our podcast, you will hear how digital banking plays a leading role for community-minded financial institutions from the unique perspectives of our industry expert guests.
You know, your podcast hasn't officially made it until there's ads in it. But this is one you're not going to want to skip past. And, well, if you do, feel free to hit that fast forward 15 seconds button twice. Ever wonder what gives me my energy and enthusiasm during these podcasts? You know, outside of my relentless desire to learn about, connect, share, and build up community FIs and their mission to support the communities they serve, it's coffee and lots of it. Now, you want to know what's better than your regular old coffee? How about donating $5 to the Children's Miracle Network Hospitals through Credit Unions for Kids every time you purchase high-quality, ethically sourced coffee that also provides living wages to coffee farmers? So if you want to listen to this episode with epic levels of caffeine-induced focus and help kids in need, head to javaforkids.org to learn more and buy a bag or 10. Thanks.
Welcome to another episode of the Digital Banking Podcast. My guest today is Steven Ramirez, CEO of Beyond the Arc. Let's be honest here. Not everyone is comfortable with change. We see it all the time and in many different ways and scenarios. Even less people are comfortable with being uncomfortable. This is the place my new friend and guest, Steven, likes to live in. He likes to try and tackle challenges in new ways and challenge the status quo. Where he gets really excited and passionate, though, is helping those of us who are maybe not so comfortable or intrinsically motivated in embracing change to do things differently than how we've always done them. As we were talking about it, though, laughingly, Steven noted, I am not a change therapist, though. I'm not trying to just help people be comfortable with change for the sake of change. He said he's trying to help organizations and leaders make changes that are necessary for survival and maintaining relevance and generating revenue. As someone who's fascinated by these intellectual challenges, he likes to use data to drive a lot of his decisions and opinions. But he also noted that over the years, he's softened the sometimes harshness of data with a balance of the emotional or intuitive side of opinions and decision-making, which I will add has made him intimately thoughtful about the fact that we may disagree mildly or even strongly about something, but we should still be able to be friends at the end of the day. With a background in global marketing for major motion picture studios, Steven brought his approach, observations, and experience to the world of customer experience. He found one of the most exciting spaces to apply his talents was in banking because, well, banking could sometimes use a lot of help when it comes to customer experience. Thankfully, he's a fan of both Star Wars and Star Trek, so we won't have to start this podcast off with a heated battle that ends with us not being friends at the end. So, Steven, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for being my guest today.
Hey, thanks for having me. Looking forward to our conversation today.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We kind of got introduced through LinkedIn, and as we got to chatting, you know, you started throwing some ideas at me of things that you'd be interested in talking about on the podcast. And man, you got me really excited right off the bat, because I think these are big topics that our industry is really wrestling with. And what I think is really interesting is, you know, it is kind of a balance of looking at, hey, this may be how we've always done things, but how are, you know, external factors impacting our need to change to, you know, as you really thoughtfully called out, you know, maintain that relevancy and continue to generate revenue. And in the banking space, that's a really interesting topic these days. So, you know, as you've kind of gotten to really use that background of customer experience journeys and apply it to banking, you know, what do you think, just to kick things off, is one of the biggest challenges facing the banking industry today in that regard?
So I think if you think about banking, and I do, I think about my earliest experiences with banking, and I'll say, I recall very clearly when I opened up my first checking account. I was in high school, and there was what the bank that is now, well, I'll just say, I walked down the street to a major national bank and opened up my first account, and at the age of 13, and have had one ever since. And now that I'm 18, I have 5 years of experience. Oh wait, no, I have a few more years of experience with that. But in the banking model of the past, it was really one size fits all, you know. And in the best case scenario, it was one size fits most, right? So maybe you could have some slight different flavor. You couldn't go from, you know, from vanilla to pistachio, but maybe you could go from vanilla to French vanilla, right? Like, so there was very, very little difference in the ways that financial institutions, banks and credit unions and wealth management firms, they all approached the business the same way, with a focus on the product, a focus on themselves, not really a focus on clients. And I think that for decades, I think that they were able to maintain that posture for decades. But then one day, I think that digital happened. And I think that digital innovators changed our expectations of what's possible. And from that, you know, we've seen these seamless digital experiences change the way that we think about retail, how we think about information gathering, how we think about entertainment. And I think, Josh, we're like, hey, if I can have this really cool, efficient, tailored experience that I love and seems really intuitive to me, why can't I have that in financial services? I think that that is the essential tension that we still see. And there's reasons for that. You know, we can get into that. But I think that that's the essential problem that still needs to be solved.
You know, it's funny that this conversation is kind of timely. I was taking an Uber ride yesterday. And, you know, I just got to talking to, he was a younger kid, probably in his, you know, mid-20s or so, who was my Uber driver. And, you know, he was just asking me the, you know, quintessential, like, small talk questions, you know, what do you do for work? And, you know, I was telling him that I work, you know, in digital for financial services, and that I oversee, you know, brand evangelism and marketing. And somehow we got to talking about, you know, how much fun that is for me. And he was asking me some of the reasons why, because he was trying to break into marketing, and he'd done some marketing for some other companies. And he was just kind of curious of, like, what were the challenges that, you know, I as a marketer to this space faced. And we were talking a lot about what you were just talking about, right? Is that, you know, the industry that we provide services to has had some really significant changes over even just the last couple of years, but really over the last couple of decades. And a lot of it is because, you know, we're trying to, you know, quote unquote, sell a product into a space that is a very traditional space, right? They're very accustomed to a specific model of a brick and mortar. And my customers, my members, they come into my financial institution. We have face-to-face conversations with them. We develop relationships with them, and we differentiate that way. And, you know, we were talking about how, especially in days of the past, you know, I'd walk down the street, need to open a checking account, and I'd have, you know, financial institution A on one side of the street and financial institution B on the other side of the street. And, you know, how do they differentiate themselves? And like you said, I mean, to be totally honest, like, it's vanilla or maybe French vanilla. And, you know, our savings account rates are 0.25% higher than theirs are, but their auto rate is 0.5% lower than mine is. And, you know, we kind of did battle that way. And then hopefully I stepped foot into the physical branch, and then you really sold me on your differentiator of, you knew who I was. You were going to build that relationship with me. You were going to be there for me. You were going to care for me. You were a part of my community, et cetera. And that whole world has changed, right? And that was the exact conversation I had with this young man was, you know, I asked him, I was like, oh, hey, I'm just curious. When was the last time you went into a branch? And he goes, I don't even know if I have.
Right.
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 So all of a sudden, we've got to think very, very differently about how do we attract and retain customers. And what is that experience like in a digital world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that hits on a lot of key things there. I think that, you know, on one hand, just this conversation with the Uber driver, you know, I think it's an indicator of one of the key changes, which is, you know, the way that people earn a living has changed, right? Like that is one of the key things. And I don't know of a single person under 30 who does not have a side hustle, a gig job, another source of income. And this has profoundly changed the way that they manage their finances, right? So I think that people and the way that they manage their finances have changed. I think that what we've seen recently is, of course, our economic environment, which had been relatively stable for the last, let's say, the last 17 years, you know, now that we're in this environment where interest rates have actually ticked up in a significant way, inflation is now firmly on everyone's conversation. These things have changed. These have broken these patterns of the last couple of decades. And I think that we're at a sort of a special moment in time. So consumers have changed, the economy has changed, you know, and I'll even say, I think that whatever vestiges of the kind of traditional model were in place, I think the pandemic really blew a lot of that out of the water for even, you know, people. I'll tell you, I myself had, and perhaps I'm showing my age, I had a tradition where on my way to work, I'd get off the train, I would stop by my bank because it was on the way to my office, and I would deposit a check actually across the teller, you know, and I just did it because it was easy. And that was just part of my tradition. But with the pandemic and my work, you know, my work from home schedule completely obliterated that set of patterns. And so any interaction that I had with the branch before is completely gone. So I think that customers have changed, the economy has changed, but you know what hasn't changed very much? Banks, credit unions. Right. So this, I think is a critical issue. Because why? Well, what's the issue? Well, because now we've seen this onslaught of non-bank competitors who are out to peel off the most valuable segments of customers, right? They don't want all the customers. They just want your most valuable ones. And for those customers, they are putting a full court press. And so I think it's very, banks and credit unions are in a very vulnerable position where so many things have changed, but they are not keeping up with the times.
Oh man, I was like furiously trying to write some notes because you gave me a lot of things that we're going to have to come back to because each one of those deserves kind of a deeper dive. I want to give our listeners a little bit of, you know, peek behind the curtain here. You know, one of the things that I do as a part of just setting each of our guests up is, you know, ask them just for kind of a couple of bullet points of some of the topics that they're really passionate about, excited about, want to talk about or interested in, want to have conversations around. And I actually want to share like verbatim one of the ones that you put on the sheet, because I think it speaks perfectly to what you were just talking about. And you said, differentiation, why having friendly tellers just doesn't cut it. And so we're seeing a lot of changes in the environment, right? And so just having friendly tellers, like you say, this is not going to cut it anymore if no one ever goes in to see the teller, right? Don't get me wrong. There's still plenty of people that come in to see the teller. So you do have an opportunity to differentiate when that happens. It's not like tellers are going away tomorrow. It's not like branches are going away tomorrow. That's not what we're trying to say here, right? I think we can agree on that.
Absolutely.
They're not going away tomorrow. There are still people that use that channel, that use that mode of interaction, but there's a larger segment that is not. So how are you going to differentiate to that segment? So I wanted to get kind of your thoughts on, as you're talking about these changes and, you know, differentiation is no longer going to be just having friendly tellers. One, what does that mean? What are the changes that are affecting that? And then two, how do you think we need to start rethinking differentiation?
So let's start with the data, right? Because, you know, I don't think that anyone needs to take our word for this. When we say that, you know, there are fewer branch visits, there are fewer telephone calls, and there are more digital interactions. I know that I've seen this across the industry from sources like the FDIC and others that have discussed, the trends, you know, the count of transactions through various channels. So I'd say, first of all, if you doubt that this applies to you, now's a good time to look at the trend in channel usage for various customer segments, and particularly if you can overlay that with a sense of your most profitable customers, right? And so how are the interactions of your most profitable customers changing? So I think this is the sense of urgency that there is this vulnerability, right? So the question is then, how do you, if everyone has the same products, how do you truly differentiate? And I would say you cannot differentiate on product as you might like to. And I think that goes to some of the challenges from a regulatory perspective. Like at the end of the day, a deposit account is a deposit account is a deposit account. There are very few opportunities, I think, to create true differentiation. But I think that in this digital economy, that what we've seen is that that differentiation can come from, it's not what you offer, and it's not even about the experience that you are focused on providing. It really is about how you make me feel, right? So how do you, as a financial institution, how do you make me feel? This, I think, Josh, is where we could go in terms of finding a basis of differentiation that then we can wrap our products and services and customer engagement strategies around, this idea of putting the customer and their feelings and their needs in really sort of a human and kind of customer-centric model. This, I think, can be differentiating.
I want to come back to that and how do you start thinking about using customer experience and data and things like AI to start thinking about how we differentiate in that space. But before we do, I wanted to come back to one of the comments that you made, because I think it's going to influence the upcoming conversation. One, you know, I want to challenge the thought, not because I disagree with you, but because I think it's going to get you to talk. You know, you made the comment that like banks and credit unions just have not changed. And I'd argue that they absolutely have, right? Like there are a lot of them that are changing, that are doing some really good things, that are putting bigger focuses on, you know, quote unquote, digital transformation, however you want to define that. I don't know if we have time for that one today, given all the other things we want to talk about, but you're right, right? Like, I think in the grand scheme of things, they haven't changed. Like a lot of financial institutions, community financial institutions, especially smaller ones that have the ability to move fairly quickly and pivot, they've done a good job of changing. But I think maybe what you were more so alluding to was what you just touched on, which is a deposit account is a deposit account is a deposit account. Like there's only so much you can change in the products that you offer. It's not like you went from, you know, selling a, you know, Fiat to a Ferrari. You're not all of a sudden going to change something that drastically in terms of the products that you offer. So, you know, community financial institutions are still, quote unquote, selling the same products they've always sold. And in somewhat traditional, you know, competitive ways, like we were just talking about, like, well, my auto rate is 0.5% lower than the guys down the street. And, you know, their CD rate is, you know, 1% higher than mine. And so there's some of that, but that's what I think you're talking about has not changed, right?
Yes. And I would say you bring up a great point. And I would say a couple of reactions to that. I think that one, it is actually far easier for the largest banks and the largest credit unions to innovate because they, in some cases, have billions of dollars that they can deploy in terms of new technology. So it makes it far easier for them to look at a whole range of different solutions. I think it's much harder for regional and community financial institutions to drive innovation in the same way. But I think that I would say while there's a lot of talk about innovation, I do believe that a lot of it does fall into the category of the innovation theater, where we can discuss our passion and commitment to innovation. But if we get down to brass tacks and say, okay, so let's look at new solutions, you know, particularly I think technology-driven solutions that your financial institution has implemented in the last 18 months, how many are there? Let's show me the receipts. Like, let's count them up. Like, let's see how many we're talking about, because I think that that's where the rubber hits the road. And I can tell you that I know that there's a community financial institution that we work with, just under $3 billion in assets, and you know, they have, over the course of these last couple of years, I mean, they're now probably, they've probably crossed over with 20 new technology-enabled, customer-focused solutions that they have deployed. But I think that they are, unfortunately, bit of a unicorn as we look kind of across the industry.
Yeah, that is a good point. I mean, I think we're all kind of victim of that sometimes too, right? Like we talk about the shiny objects a lot. How often do we actually catch them? You know, and it's a mix of balancing, you know, different priorities, resources, like you said, budget. You know, I think that is an interesting space, especially for our community financial institutions, is a lot of times they have some really great ideas. They have some really great staff. And sometimes they don't have the budget to actually implement it. But conversely, sometimes they have really great ideas, really great staff, some just true grit, and they just get her done.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right? And they're also able to pivot faster. So I think that's one of the, the advantages. Larger institutions have more resources and more capital to deploy. And a lot of times the smaller institutions have maybe less roadblocks or internal challenges to be able to deploy some of those things. But ultimately, it comes down to the culture of the institution, whether big or small, whether you actually prioritize and catch those shiny squirrels, or if you just talk a lot about them.
Absolutely. And I think that is a part that to me is exciting about this, is that absolutely community financial institutions can do this, right? This is not beyond your grasp. And to me, now this gets to the point of differentiation. I think that you do this by understanding the customers that you are serving and understanding them better than anybody else. And not just, you know, not, and this gets to the friendliness, not just being able to remember their name when they come into the branch, but to really understand what is driving their needs. What are the, from a customer experience perspective, the jobs that they need to get done? Like, how are they trying, like, what are they trying to accomplish? You know, the money is a way for them to fulfill their financial and personal goals. How do you, as a community financial institution, enable that? How do you, because you have an incredible ability to really hone in on those specific customers and serve them in ways that others cannot. That's my contention. Now, it's a battle, because when we apply more sophisticated technology like machine learning and AI, that can be an equalizer that enables some of these technology-enabled competitors, particularly non-banks, to come after some of the most profitable customers of the community financial institutions.
Way to bring that right back to literally the question I wanted to ask you next, which is, you know, you kind of touched on this whole, you know, new competition is coming, and they are, they're being really thoughtful and smart about, hey, no offense, but I don't want your unprofitable customers.
That's right.
You know, I don't want those folks who literally just have a bare bones checking account and, you know, write a handful of checks off of it every once in a while. Like, I want your profitable customers. So I'm going to go figure out who they are. I'm going to figure out how to message to them. I'm going to differentiate myself. And then I'm going to go and I'm going to aggressively attack that market. So, and my question is, who do you see as kind of the competitors that are entering into the space? And then how are they approaching, you know, trying to steal away the most profitable customers from community financial institutions?
Yeah. So Josh, do you have the Apple card?
You know, okay, funny story. Sorry, we'll sidetrack on this a little bit. So obviously in my line of work, it's really, really important for me to have accounts all over the place, try all the different products and services. So I have a good understanding of the experiences, what others are offering, what technology advancements are happening. On top of that, I'm a total Apple junkie. I have just bought every Apple product. My whole house runs on Apple Home. Like, I'm nerded out. I'm in the ecosystem. Apple's got my money. I'm screwed. I could never leave. But I don't have an Apple card. And I literally did it on principle. Because someone else on my team got an Apple card before I did. And I got to go through the experience. So I got what I needed out of it. And then I was like, but I won't get the Apple card out of respect for my friends that I sell products to. So anyway, that's my long story why I don't have an Apple card.
Okay, but now, so did the person who had the Apple card, did they get the Apple savings account?
I don't know. I'll have to actually check
because
back that, on that.
So here's the answer to your question. Like, so the competitive threat we fought, you know, as recently as a year or two ago, we thought that the most compelling threat was going to come from the neobanks and the up and coming fintech lenders, right? That looked like the biggest challenge. I think that in today's world, I don't think it's the fintech. I think it's the big tech that is going to be the most severe competitors. And I think that Apple is a great example. So as you know, that the experience for the Apple card to apply for and receive and be able to start spending on the Apple card, I didn't clock it, but if it took more than a minute, it was only by seconds, right? I mean, this was a minute experience. But it's not just the credit product that they have. I think that the truly concerning part was how easy it was to bridge that to a deposit relationship and to be able to offer, in this case, a pretty attractive rate. So rate was definitely part of the financial strategy. I think it's with Goldman, I think it's at 4.15%, which is pretty, which I'll just pause there. Hey, if you're a financial institution and you're still offering, you know, 0.18, you know, as opposed to, you know, above 4, you got a problem. But the same seamless experience of opening the card account was equally easy to open the savings account and nanoseconds to be able to fund that account and super easy to be able to move money back and forth between that savings account and accounts at other financial institutions, right? So I think that the essence is still the seamless digital experience. Like that's the through line. And I will tell you, it enabled me and I know, you know, at least a million, you know, million plus more to be able to very seamlessly move deposits from a place where they had been parked for the better part of a decade to a new account relationship because of the seamlessness of this money movement. Right? Like that to me shows you what the competitive threat is. And now this goes to the other part, which is, you know, we are in this different economic environment where interest rates matter. And so, you know, inertia only gets you so far. And now I think that people like me are waking up from our decade-long sleep of inertia. And so the competition comes from big tech, well, you know, well-financed competitors who could offer a hyper level of convenience and good rates, right? I mean, that's sort of like, wouldn't we say that's like the full package, right?
Oh man, again, you give me so many things to unpack in just one go of you talking.
All right, I'll try to tune it down a little bit, all right?
No, I love it. You know, you got me thinking when you were talking about it, a couple of things. You know, I had a guest on a while ago, George Estrada from AWS, and he made a comment and he said, absolutely, big tech is coming in. They're coming for your business. And he goes, if you want to combat big tech, work with bigger tech. Right. And so he was kind of talking about, there are big tech that are looking to disrupt the space from the standpoint of doing what you do, just trying to do it better. But there's also big tech that is trying to disrupt your space, but by enabling you to do things differently. And I thought that was a really interesting, you know, kind of addition to what you were just talking about. So what are your thoughts on that?
You know, I think you nailed it. And I will, and here's what I can share with you. So I can tell you that in some of our client relationships, one of the hottest topics for banks is how to integrate fintech partnerships and to work through their go-to-market model. And I see this, the largest banks are all over this. Like they have crossed over. To your point, they've realized, hey, we don't have to beat them. You know, meaning we can have a partnering strategy that enables us to make our offering even more compelling and leverage our key advantages. And so I do not think that community financial institutions have thought as strategically about the value of fintech partnership. I think that they are still, and I've done, you know, thought leadership and training on this. It's like, it is not a vendor relationship. You are not buying, you know, the product. You are using this fintech partnership to drive transformation and enable new capabilities. I don't see that thinking yet taking root. I don't know if you see it differently, but I'm not seeing it take root in regional and community institutions.
I definitely do. I mean, but it's on a smaller level. And I think, you know, again, it depends on the culture of the institution, like we talked about earlier. I think there are a lot of institutions that are wanting to say, hey, you know what? It's time that we start looking at best in breed and we start looking at new offerings and things that allow us to differentiate or, you know, further expand upon a current differentiation in a digital means. And they're looking at kind of these fintech partnerships. But, you know, there are also a lot of people that are just super okay with, you know, checking mark in the easy box. And hey, I just want, you know, my digital in a box. I want you to tell me which service providers I should use for these, you know, five common features that need to be in my digital banking, and we'll call it a day. So there's absolutely that camp. And I'll say it really bluntly. I feel like you guys are in trouble. Like that trouble is coming. It's here. But I definitely think there are others that are starting to dabble in that. But I want to touch on what I think might be the next generation of that in a second. But I want
go ahead. No, let's go there.
Well, so I like that you use the example of Apple, right? And the Apple Card. Because absolutely, they are offering a different vanilla pudding, right? Mm-hmm. But it's still vanilla pudding. It's still a savings account. They're just differentiating on the experience. I think one of the reasons they're able to absolutely crush the user experience side is they also own the device.
Yes.
And owning the device does have a significant role to play here.
Yes.
But what I thought is interesting is when you use the example of Apple, right? And you even touched on this point, right? Like we were talking about, you know, AWS saying, hey, if you want to fight big tech, use bigger tech. Obviously, a little shameless plug for themselves and calling themselves the biggest tech, which I don't necessarily disagree with. But, you know, just like they're encouraging community financial institutions to partner with big tech is having to partner with traditional financial institutions for also reasons you touched on earlier, things like regulatory compliance, right? And you mentioned it, like Apple Card is backed by Goldman, mm-hmm. right? They're backed by a traditional financial institution. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there in that, you know, traditional financial institutions, one of the, you know, little perks that they have is cost of capital. So the ability to provide better rates is going to be provided to kind of that traditional financial institution model. But as regulations change, as lobbying power changes, that may change as well. But, you know, today that's a kind of a feather in their cap. But you start looking at the way Apple is leveraging Goldman. So I guess where I'm going with all of this is, you know, one of the things that I think as we're talking about just leveraging fintechs and embedding more fintechs is also just this idea of embedded banking, embedded fintech, embedded finance, right? And that's also going to have a really big impact. And you're seeing that with exactly what you referenced in the Apple Card.
Absolutely. And I think that that's another, you've hit it, nailed it. And I think that this idea of, you know, I'll say the broadly embedded finance. And I think that within that, you know, there's lots of different slices. You know, there's embedded traditional banking products, embedded payments, but that could also include embedded financial advisory. That could be embedded insurance. It is essentially, again, now from like a big picture technology perspective, we recognize that through APIs that we can take just about any two systems and connect them, right? And so it gives us the ability that anything that a bank offers can be offered as a service, right? So we're really talking about banking as a service. And I don't just mean the platform of, you know, deposit accounts, but truly all things banking being offered as a service. I think to your point, this becomes very compelling and very interesting. And as a small institution, no, you cannot do it all. But perhaps there are a couple of pieces that would really be complementary to what you do. And therefore, this kind of indirect sales channel is the way I think about it, is that you don't have to sign up the end user customers. You're going through this fintech partner. That could be a fantastic way to be able to build deposits, develop new relationships by being the back end enabler from a bank perspective.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think it's worthwhile to maybe even just like simplify it down into a really simple concept, right? If you think about, there's kind of two sides of the coin here, right? You can have, and again, I'm just going to make it a very, very simple example. You can have your bank or credit union's digital banking, and you can offer the ability for your account holders to, you know, buy shoes through a local retailer within your digital banking. And then on the flip side, that shoe retailer can also offer a way for you to pay through your financial institution within their shopping experience. So there's kind of two different sides of the same coin. And I think that's what you were touching on is, you know, in one sense, in the you can buy shoes through my digital banking app, that's helping us to deepen and strengthen current existing relationships. But being able to say you can pay for those shoes through my payment mechanisms that are being offered through this, you know, shoe retailer's app, that's giving you a way where you're potentially gaining new account holders without having to go out and do the marketing. So I think there's two separate opportunities, and it's been kind of interesting to see different financial institutions dabble in one, both, or neither of those two sides of the coin.
Yeah, I think that you explained that very well. And I think that on the, I would just add an additional dimension to this and to say, you know, we've been talking a lot about consumers and kind of consumer segments, but I think that this is just as applicable to both small business and to commercial segments as well. And so I think about it as like, if as a bank, let's say you're partnering with a marketplace, and it could be a marketplace for anything. Let's say, you know, let's say it's a marketplace for aircraft parts, right? So in the aircraft parts marketplace, there are buyers and sellers. You know, buyers and sellers need means of transaction. So there's a need for payments, but there's also a need perhaps for payment acceptance, as well as deposit accounts and earning money and liquidity. Like, these can all be parts of a marketplace. And in this case, I'm saying aircraft parts and supply, but could be powered by a local community institution who is providing kind of the backbone of these regulated products that help to enable the financial transactions through this marketplace.
I'm really glad you brought up small business, Stephen, because, you know, this brings us back to what we were talking about earlier of just change is already here, right? There's a lot of change that's happening. And one of those changes is just in the way people do work, right? And going back to my example of my Uber driver, like 10 years ago, there was no such thing as Uber drivers, right? There was no way for you to just be like, you know what? Actually, I have a car.
I got some spare time. I'm going to drive people around in my spare car or in my car in my spare time. I'm going to make a few bucks on the side. Like, that didn't exist. You were either a cab driver or you were not a cab driver. And all of a sudden, there's this whole massive new way for this, you know, gig economy, this gig worker to be able to say, I'm going to earn a little side money, right? So now we have all of these brand new small businesses. How are they being served? So there's changes that are happening also kind of outside of our world of traditional banking that are opening up opportunities. And the question is, how are we changing and adapting to serve those new opportunities in those new markets with the changes that are happening inside of our space as well?
I think that's that again, I think that hits it. And I think it's taking, there's been discussion, of course, about people saying, well, you know, for those people, is it a consumer account? Is it a small business account? Which product do I need to sell them? Right? That's the FI mindset. Which one should I be selling them? Right? But I think that sort of flipping that around from that, you know, from the person or from the driver perspective, you know, what are the challenges that they face in terms of how they manage their financial life? And what does it mean in terms of they now don't have a regular stable paycheck that comes every 2 weeks. They might actually have the same level of earnings or greater through four different gigs that they do, but it doesn't look the same. And so now what happens when they come in and they want an auto loan to be able to buy a new car? How do you manage the underwriting for that? What is that? That no longer fits, you know, the model. I think that's like a really clear, you know, and you could say, well, no, that's a commercial business. That's a commercial driver now. So that goes under our commercial lending team. And, you know, we're not going to give, you know what I mean? You could just sort of see trying to struggle to put the, you know, to force fit that what the customer is trying to accomplish.
That's a great example. And I think, you know, I think I've used this example in the past too, where, you know, you look at something like Square and how Square now has Square Capital. And, you know, you're now the point of sale terminal for a small coffee shop. And you're actually able to take data, direct transactional data that's happening at that point of sale system and say, hey, we see that you've been selling a ton of your, you know, French roast beans, and you consistently run out of inventory for that. But we also see that anytime you have it in inventory, you're selling it. So right here on your point of sale terminal, business owner, here's a $10,000 small business loan to go buy more French roast beans so you can have a higher stock, so you can sell more of it, so you can make more money. And all of a sudden, it's directly applicable to their business. It's a really safe bet for Square because they've got all that transaction data, right? And I think that's a great example that you gave too of something similar, right? Like, you've got this person who's coming to you saying, I want an auto loan. And you're like, well, I don't know where you fit in our auto loan. You know, it looks like you just kind of do odd jobs. And like, well, I'm getting this auto loan to drive more Uber with a more reliable car or maybe a nicer car. And maybe now I can be a part of, you know, Uber Black and I can earn a little bit more money if I get this loan. And so it's not quite that traditional black and white model. It's changing. And, you know, that again brings us back to, I want to continue talking about this. That's an example of where disruption is happening, because that's an example of somebody that's looking outside in and going, ooh, that could be a profitable customer that I could steal. And I could do it by looking at the data of what they're doing, how they're doing it, what they're earning, and what I can offer them safely. So, you know, how do you see people using data and insights and forming kind of niche products, services to go after the most profitable customers of community financial institutions?
Well, I think that the competitors from big tech and fintech have built their businesses on this. Like, this is the essence of what drives their business. And if you look at the value drivers in those businesses, it really is about the data, gaining insights, and taking action. That is what their business is about. I think if you look at financial institutions, the challenge is that they have not put data high on their radar from a strategic perspective. That means that in some cases, probably the biggest constraint is that they are working with a core provider that has not made the data easy to access, and you have to go through sort of tremendous effort to be able to overcome that. And I'll just say this bank that I was referencing earlier, one of the things that we worked with them on was trying to map out a cloud-based strategy to be able to get data out of the core so they could do more advanced predictive modeling and forward-looking analysis by unlocking their data. But in order to unlock the data, you have to have an environment to be able to work with it. You have to have talent. There's lots of different pieces of that puzzle. But be that as it may, I think but first of all, you just have to be thinking about data as a strategic asset. I would say second is in these partnerships where banks are partnering with fintechs, I also don't know that banks are demanding access to their data as a part of those agreements. And so I think that sometimes banks wake up and find that in the terms that they've signed in some of these technology partnerships, they do not have access to their data in the way that they thought they would. And so that means they cannot come up with those really interesting insights because the insights come from data that they cannot unlock. Like those are the constraints that I think that they're facing.
Do you have any other examples that you can just have on the top of your brain of, you know, using data to say, this is a really profitable customer, we're going to create a niche segment, really crush user experience and go after and steal that niche segment?
Yeah, I mean, I see this on a frequent basis, and without revealing any confidential strategies, I can at least kind of give you some areas. So I think in one case, you know, everybody's talking about deposits right now, right? Everybody wants to attract deposits. I think even more important is how you retain deposits and the level of segmentation and targeting and niche strategies to be able to identify and retain certain vulnerable deposit customers. Not the customers. This is, I think, is the issue. People think about the customers being won or lost. It's actually about the deposits being siphoned away, right? So I think that this is one way of being able to use data to identify the opportunities to protect deposits that you have with certain high value segments. I think that's one example.
Well, yeah, I want to come back to that too. Let's put a pin in that because, you know, I think the biggest example of that is what we're starting to see of just the great wealth transfer, mm-hmm. right? And an aging population from community financial institutions. And as, say it bluntly, as they die off, where's that money go?
Yes.
Right? Where are those deposits being put? Are they staying at your institution with the next generation or are they going somewhere else? But before we do, I wanted to go back to just this idea of, you know, community financial institutions being able to actually access and leverage and use the data. You know, I agree. I think we see this a lot of times that a lot of the community financial institutions that we work with don't have access to their data. It gets actually really funny when, you know, when we're talking to community financial institutions and I tell them, you know, our position on data is we are simply custodians. We are not owners. It is your data. Do what you want with it, how you want with it, where you want to do it. But that's like a novel concept in our industry. But in so much other software, that's kind of the status quo there, right?
It is.
But I do think that's changing, right? I don't think we're unique in that space. I think a lot of the digital banking providers, I think a lot of the different, you know, third-party integration providers And even some of the core providers are like, hey, no, it's your data. You can have it. So I do think there is a shift to that. But I think there, to your point, there is still a lot of roadblocks there, especially folks that have been on legacy systems. And especially those folks that, like we called out earlier, kind of maybe hit that easy button and were like, hey, just give me the simple platform. You make all the choices. Just give me the simple contract design, deploy it standard. You own it. You manage it. I think they're going to be in the worst of the boats in terms of being able to access and leverage data. But even when we have access to the data, there's a big problem, right? And it's being able to actually dissect that data, actually understand that data, know what it's telling you, know what pieces of data you need to put together to give you the picture that you need to be able to make informed strategic decisions about, you know, what your objectives should be, how you should go after certain markets, you know, and I'll say part of the problem, especially going back to community financial institutions, is what you talked about earlier, is just resources and capital, right? I mean, we just hired a guy, you know, sorry in advance, we just hired a guy that was, you know, formerly at MetaPay and like PhD in AI and ML. And I'm just going to say it, dude wasn't cheap, right? And he was real hard to recruit, but it's because he knows the value that he offers these days. And for a community financial institution, you know, you're a $500 million credit union in rural Iowa, being able to attract that kind of talent is going to be tough. So especially if you don't have a strategy that says, you know, we're going to put a stake in the ground. We put value on this. We know this may be one of the highest paid people at our institution, but we got to do it. Like we've got to get this type of personality in to be able to access, leverage, understand, and do something with all this data if we have gotten access to it. Like that's a whole nother problem unto itself.
It absolutely is. And there are many steps. There are many steps to it. So part of our work is with financial institutions to map out these data to customer strategy. And so to your point, the first set of challenges is getting the data and getting it into an environment where you can use it. But it really does require kind of an end-to-end process to be able to, there are certain required enablers is how I think about it. There's a set of required enablers and you have to have all the pieces of the set. You can't have the data without the talent. You can't have the talent without the data infrastructure. You can't have the talent and the data infrastructure without the linkage back to the business strategy. Because otherwise you wind up with this kind of navel gazing. You just sort of like look at data and you come up with sort of gee whiz kinds of projects, but they don't actually move the needle from an ROI perspective, right? So if we're really talking about using data to change the nature of customer relationships and boost profitability, that doesn't happen by chance. Like that requires, and I can now say, having gone through that with different institutions over time, really from an end-to-end perspective, that's really sort of a 2 to 4 year time horizon. Like you start today on the fastest path, I think that you're starting to see some initial results in 2 years and you're starting to hit your stride in 4 years, right? Like that realistically is kind of what the horizon looks like to be able to get in the game from a data and insights perspective. With a caveat, there are some quick wins, and I think that there's a focus on trying to hit some milestones along the way, but to really have the flywheel going, you know, that's a multi-year journey.
Yeah, no, that brings up an important element of that as well. And I think you'd probably be able to expand on this a little bit, is it also takes a culture of the institution, right?
Massively.
So if you do, like you go in and invest in, you know, a data scientist and you put all these systems in place and then your CEO or your board or, you know, your executive leadership team just always shoots down everything or says, oh gosh, that's a 2-year project, or we've been doing this for 2 years and we haven't seen any results yet, kill the project, then you're probably also not going to actually recognize the maximum amount of benefit out of these types of data-driven programs.
Can I say that more bluntly? You are going to fail. You are going to fail. I have gravitated to thinking that the most important factor is actually that executive vision and engagement. That is the most important factor because, as you say, it does help to create the, I think of it as a kind of a culture of data-driven decision-making, that this is what we really need to transition to. And then things like machine learning and AI are the ways that we execute on that to be able to get the insights. But it really does have to start from the top. You really do have to have, because it is a long journey, because it does involve a series of steps, and the outcome when you begin doesn't look like it's clear. And so you have to have a leader who's willing to lead that charge.
Well, and like you were saying, I mean, that those processes have to start now.
Yes.
Because they take time. And the problem is that time is kind of no longer on the side of community financial institutions, right? You just gave that example of, you know, the great wealth transfer is happening. And we're starting to lose some of our most profitable customers, literally to aging out. And you're starting to see that shift in deposits. So, you know, if you're not already on a path to getting access to leveraging and understanding and taking actually, you know, strategic moves against what the data is telling you of how money is moving at your institution, like you're already in the thick of it. That money is moving. So, what are you seeing in terms of kind of an aging population that has really been the customer base of the community-minded, you know, traditional financial institution? As they're aging out, as that wealth transfer is happening, what are you seeing in that space?
Well, I think that the industry research that I've seen, I mean, first of all, just to put this into perspective, you know, with the recent uptick in the stock market and just an overall sort of increase in wealth, you know, we're now looking at a potential of somewhere in the neighborhood of $68 trillion of assets that are at stake. And that this is money that's going to transfer to millennials and Gen Z. And, you know, and now the millennials, you know, we talk about millennials. I mean, these are people who are in their early 40s, right? So they're very profoundly different from other sort of prior age segments, you know. So for example, they are not as likely to be married and have kind of a traditional family structure as previous generations. They are more racially diverse than previous generations. And I think that one of the most significant and surprisingly under the radar is that in this transfer, more financial decision making will wind up in the hands of women than ever before. Because in previous eras, even women, even as inheritees, did not have the same level of respect and financial control, even when they were inheriting the money. So that has all now changed. And so this is very, very different. And the information that I've seen, you know, I think you could use this as a data point, is to say that, you know, sort of survey says that up to 80% of heirs expect to be looking for a new financial home after they inherit their, you know, after they receive their inheritance. Right. So I think that this shows you that there's huge changes taking place. And again, this is not only the ultra high net worth or even the high net worth. I think that these are trends, in my opinion, that we see also in the affluent and reasonably well off. Right. I think these are societal forces at play that very dramatically hit on the community financial institutions.
I would challenge that to say, I'd be really curious to get some of our community financial institutions to look at some of their data here.
Absolutely.
Because I bet you anything, Stephen, I bet you it goes way beyond that even. I don't even think we're talking about people who are about to inherit $10 million. I don't think we're even talking about people that are about to inherit $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're literally also talking about the fact that there is an extremely high percentage of your community financial institution's overall assets under management and deposits that is in the top age group of your customer base.
Absolutely.
And so even if it's $5,000, well, if 80% of those $5,000 accounts are with people in their 60s and up, that money's gonna move, right? So all of a sudden, yeah, it's only $5,000 here and $5,000 there. But if it makes up, you know, 80% of your deposits, and all of a sudden, all of these folks start to age out, to pass on, that $5,000 goes to whoever it goes to. Where's their financial institution? Where's that deposit going to go?
I think that we have to break ourselves out of the thinking that, you know, oh, everybody's got a primary financial institution. It'll probably go to their primary financial institution. You know, so I have a Gen Z son, and, you know, his primary financial institutions live as apps on his phone. Right. And so I think that he is not alone. And I think that increasingly we'll see this uptake. So I think it's about thinking, how should we be serving these clients and how are their needs different? You know, and the one that I, from the wealth perspective, one that I think about is, you know, let's connect the dots on the growing gig economy and what we see as the future of work, and how people are not just, you know, getting a job and staying there for 10 years, but instead have this whole portfolio of gig-related activities, maybe to supplement or to add to a full-time job. What does that person look like 20 years from now, 30 years from now, 40 years from now, as they are moving into retirement? And how well do financial institutions support the retirement of people who have grown up in the gig economy? I would say today, probably not well. that's gonna be my statement. But why couldn't you be the community or regional bank that totally nails this, and that you are the bank for gig economy workers to help them plan for the future? Like, why couldn't you be that bank? Because I don't know of a bank right now who is that bank, right?
Yeah, that's a great point. How do you think that just kind of the customer experience journey is going to impact all of this?
I think that from a customer experience perspective, there is not, this is one of the learnings, I think, from a CX industry that we've sort of realized is, oh, you know what? There's actually not the customer experience. There's customer experiences, and that our various sets of customers have very different experiences. And so I think that but there are some good tools. I think it's thinking about, first of all, the customer personas. And so really thinking about who are these kind of archetype, you know, customers, like what do they really look like? What do they think? Who are they? And then what journeys do they go through as they are trying to solve certain jobs that they need to have done, like things that they are trying to do to meet their financial goals? So I think that there's a new way of thinking about customer experience in financial services that is very exciting and is really just starting to take root. Even in organizations that have very mature CX teams, this is new ground for them.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that's a great way to kind of sum up, you know, this episode is there are a lot of challenges because there's a lot of forces at play. And there's a lot of just the traditional challenges that we've always faced, but there's also a whole slew of new challenges. So it's going to take thinking of how do we attack the old problems, the problems that we're used to attacking, but how do we also think differently, get uncomfortable, and look at the new challenges and look at them as opportunities and look for ways to continue to maintain relevance and to build revenue so that we quite frankly, stick around.
Yeah, I think that I totally agree with all of you just said. And I will just offer this I did get a chance to say this before, I am inherently an optimist. Like I see the potential in the future. And so I think that for community financial institutions, we're just laying out what the battlefield is. I think you can win. But I think that it's not going to have, you're not, what gets you there is not going to be what got you to where you are, if that makes any sense. Like your go forward strategy is not going to be what led to your success in the last 5, 10, 20 years. It's a new game, but you can win it. That's really my outlook.
I agree. And that's why I do this podcast. I want to see community financial institutions win. Well, Stephen, I feel like this was an hour plus that just blew by, just an absolutely fascinating conversation. And I really appreciate your perspectives. But before I let you go, two final questions for you. So one, you know, where do you go to get information about what's happening? I'm going to definitely say for you in specific, like within our industry, but also outside of our industry, because it sounds like you get a lot of your information and just what you're applying to the problems in financial services from outside of financial services as well. So, you know, what are some of the places that you go to get information that informs some of the data-driven and intuitive decisions that you like to make?
So I think in terms of, if I really think about my sources of information, I think that you have to be talking to people. I think that conversations like this that spark my thinking, give me a couple of new tidbits, I connect a few more dots. So I find that I learn a lot from personal connections, from connecting with people. And so to me, that translates to industry events. And so, for example, I found the Finovate conference is a place where I'm always learning something new. I've been attending and involved over the last 10 years. I also think forums like Money 2020, where you just have so many people, tens of thousands of people in one place at one time. So I think that these interactions are really key. And I think that a part of that, though, is not just talking to the same old people, but really trying to, you know, learn from startup founders, bankers, investment bankers, people in insurance, people who are running, you know, companies in other industries. I think it's learning from these human interactions across these different forums. And I'll say a close second is, you know, I have found that when it was not in person or when I wasn't connected in an event, I have learned a tremendous amount from social media, people that I've connected with through LinkedIn or through Twitter. And now, of course, Threads is the hottest thing of the last week. But I think that it is. So it's not from a particular info source, except for other people who are trying to figure this out.
Wow, that's awesome. And then what about if people want to connect with you to be able to continue conversations with you? Where can they go to connect with you, and, you know, how can they learn a little bit more about Beyond the Arc and your company and what you're doing?
Well, you know, to learn about us, the website is the starting point, so beyondthearc.com. And to engage, you know, there is not a day that passes that I'm not on LinkedIn or Twitter or now Threads.
I'm gonna say, now you got to start adding that one to it, huh?
Or a couple of others, and in all of those places, we are at Beyond the Arc. So you can I am personally driving those efforts, and so I'm engaging. So definitely reach out. Let's connect via LinkedIn. Let's connect on Twitter or Threads. I look forward to hearing from people.
Awesome. Thanks, Stephen. I tell you what, again, I just want to reiterate, this has been a blast. I love your energy and enthusiasm. I remember the first time you and I talked, which was not that long ago. I mean, we were like 2 minutes in and we were both like, okay, man, we can end this discovery call. Like, we know we're going to have a blast on this podcast, and did not disappoint. So appreciate your time, and thank you so much for coming and being a guest on the Digital Banking Podcast.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Digital Banking Podcast powered by Typhoon. Find more episodes on digitalbankingpodcast.com or subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Typhoon. Everyone builds features. Not everyone builds relationships. We build both.